is continuing with Tom Yabsley on 2nd March 78. So you were saying that you don't know about...
No, I had no real contact with the... no direct contact with the radar work that was done here, and no background on what was the status of the relative status of Allied and Japanese radar or communications technology in those times.
Okay, so what was the first task that you were assigned when you joined Posse's group?
Well, I think from memory now, again, these things are not entirely clear, but it was to help in getting observations going at one particular field station at Over Heights, invariably with old radar equipment adapted to these new tasks, but to get systems going at two or three different frequencies. The frequencies like 60 megacycles, 75, and
30 200. And 200.
Yes, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't remember personally working with 30 megacycles.
You mentioned that in that first paper. I'm not sure if the receiver was at Dover Heights, maybe it was somewhere else.
I think that particular receiver was somewhere else.
And so you worked on the receiver development primarily?
Well, not so much. It wasn't more in the way of adaption and then installing them along with Yagi antennas, simple antennas, sometimes Yagis, which we built ourselves. Just looked up a suitable recipe for a Yagi antenna and generally got the things going, and then helped to man the observing stations, shared the job of manning the observing stations to see what we could find.
Mm-hmm. It was just sort of continuously, day after day, that you were manning?
Well, between us, these activities were carried on to the extent that we could manage with the number of people we had and the various tasks, depending on the status of a particular receiver, whether it needed working on. If receivers were in working condition, we tried to be out there between us for as much time as we could manage, yes.
That required, I imagine, quite a bit of perseverance, since most of the time the sun's not doing anything.
Well, at the time when I came into the project, it wasn't very long before, of course, we had this outstanding event in early February,
1946.
Yeah. And the events then were so spectacular that one didn't need any more firing up.
I see.
You tended to want to be out there in case you missed something.
But in fact, that was unusual, though.
Yes, we didn't realise immediately how lucky we'd be, I suppose. But it was an unusual event.
Now, were you doing all of this? All of this was the Seacliff mode. I mean, you never were looking at the sun directly. It was always along the horizon. Is that correct?
I'm not sure whether that is correct now. At 200 megacycles, at first, at any rate, we probably were only looking along the horizon, because we'd gone to Dover Heights because of the existence of this steerable array. It was only steerable in the azimuthal plane. It was what was then thought of as a large rectangular array. Mm-hmm.
This is left over from the...
It was a short offence radar antenna. But there were Yagis. But how soon now, I don't remember how soon there were Yagis could watch, could follow the sun or whatever object.
I could probably get that from the papers as to how much you were looking directly. Well, let's take a break for lunch.
All right.
So let's talk about the scientific results from this that led to this Haynes Scott Yapsley and Bolton letter in Nature. I assume this is one of the first results you got once you had all these receivers working.
Yes, well, earlier results, of course, was the work that led to the paper by, what was it, Pawsey, Payne, Scott and McCready?
Right.
On the work with the Lloyd's Mirror.
On this big burst in February, yeah.
The large antenna is looking in a horizontal direction. But the other work then later led to a letter in Nature in which it was pointed out that it was irregular with this, when this were associated in time, closely in time, they were not on different wavelengths, they were not, however, simultaneous, and the high frequency energy came in first, and lower frequencies successively later, at corresponded later times, so suggesting that the mechanism was being triggered,
mm-hmm.
perhaps at different levels in the sun's atmosphere. But I would be wrong if I suggested that I didn't really have any part in thinking about the mechanism that was being done by people like D.F. Martin and Kevin Westfold, and
mm-hmm.
I forget whether Steve Smird was already in the game.
Maybe a little bit, just a bit before his time.
Yes, my work was more associated with getting valid observations, meaningful observations of the phenomena.
You also mentioned that the intensities of these different frequencies were not particularly correlated, from burst to burst.
That's right.
Was this surprising?
We didn't know what it meant at this stage. It was, I suppose, these sorts of things that led to the development of the frequency sweeping mm-hmm. idea, to get a better idea, so that one, instead of having just a few discrete frequencies well separated,
exactly.
One got a more continuous record.
And along the same line, the next paper you have is with Lahaney in Nature, in which you have 200, 600, and 1200 megahertz observations, where, however, the highest two frequencies were behaving quite differently from the 200, namely not showing bursts.
Yes, that work was the an early result. The letter to Nature was an early result of deliberate act to try and get some decent information on just what was happening at different frequencies. And we made use, again, this was still well in the time of little science. We made use of a rectangular section of the paraboloid, which was available, an old radar antenna, mm-hmm. had it mounted so that it could follow the sun all day, but you could keep the sun in the beam for several hours of the day.
What was the purpose of a rectangular section?
Well, it was, I think, probably because the antenna was built for defence work and had been made in sections that could be demounted and carted about the country and then slotted together like a Meccano set again.
Mm-hmm. So this antenna was exactly like you, like it was used during the war, the same configuration?
Yes, except for its mounting and then the special feed that was devised and put on, so the reflector was the same.
Did you build these higher frequency receivers?
Again, I don't think so. Lindsay McCree
who was my immediate superior was the
had been the head of the receiver section in the laboratory, and he still had people under him whose main task was to do just that sort of thing. And I essentially took the receiver and kept it working, was responsible for collecting the observations.
This was still at Dover Heights?
This was now at Georges Heights, another ex-defence
established a facility near Middle Harbour. It was just a convenient spot where we had land was available, and we had security as far as facilities. We operated out of it. An old wartime hut.
You also mentioned in this paper that there was a case where, for about 10 minutes, these high frequencies, the level went up by a large amount, by a factor of 30 or so.
Yes.
With very little activity at the lower frequencies.
There wasn't a great deal of activity at 200 megacycles. And there were some other, at other field stations, some observations on the same day at 100 and at 60.
Which other stations would those be?
I'm not sure where. I'm not sure who that would have been. One would have to look to see whether there's an acknowledgement.
Okay, well, we can check that later.
But the outstanding thing about this event, which incidentally happened on a holiday weekend, the best activities.
But you were out
phenomena.
There.
But I was there because we'd adopted the policy of operating, trying to operate 7 days of the week. We didn't operate the whole of the day, but because we couldn't follow the sun all day. It happened that I was out there on that particular day. We'd never seen on the 600 megacycles and 1200 megacycles up to that time. We had, apart from odd little transient bursts of a few seconds, which it was difficult to be certain were coming from the sun and not from some interference because of their transient nature. But apart from that, we'd never seen anything other than a slow change of intensity, which appeared to be correlated somewhat with sunspot activity. So that over a period of a month you might see a 50% rise or drop in the intensity. But suddenly on this afternoon, the pen on, I think this was still the era of Esteline Angus pen recorders, appeared to dominate the market.
Right.
Highly prized by us for their reliability at that time, ruggedness. The pen started to move off, up and eventually off scale, and all I could do was to rush outside and manually turn the antenna off the sun.
I see.
In both directions, and see that the level went back to the normal sky level, and then back onto the sun, and there it was high, so I turned down the receiver again and frantically calibrated so that I had some idea of what intensities meant.
How did you do the calibration over this wide dynamic range?
Oh, I think looking this morning at a photograph of the equipment, I think it was by the use of a sine wave signal generator inserting a signal. We had the noise generator to determine the noise figure of the receiver, but there was also on hand a signal generator and possibly, I really don't remember.
So this would have to be done manually right at the time?
Yeah. Unscrewing type-in connectors. Yes.
So you had to move quickly.
So I had to move quickly. Indeed. Yes, I didn't know what to do. On one hand, I didn't want to miss anything. On the other hand, I had to do something because the pen continued to move off scale.
And you wanted to have a good record of it too.
Yes. We haven't seen anything like
this before, as I say, on either 600 or 1200 megacycles. And it's interesting to observe that this note to nature on this event, which also describes in outline the survey of solar radiation that we were doing on the three frequencies, was published in April. And it was also in April 1948. It was also in April 1948 that Covington published his first, the first full account of the work that he was doing at 10.7 centimetres.
This was proceedings of the IRE?
In his was in proper IRE.
Right.
Yes.
Were you aware of that before you saw that article?
I don't know. I just probably before I saw the published proper IRE, we might have had a laboratory report from Covington. But honestly, I can't remember now. But certainly, the letter to Nature is dated January the 13th.
When you sent it in?
Yes, from the laboratory. And there's no reference to Covington there. No, I don't think we were aware that he'd seen any solar bursts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about other groups? Were you in contact with other groups at this time?
Well, not in close contact with them, because people tended to be busy out of either working at a field station or preparing to make the next trip to a field station, doing the various things that one did.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't all that close contact, but on the other hand, we all had headquarters in the same building, although some people spent very little time there.
What about...
Joe Pawsey would have been the one who was acting not only as a leader, but keeping in contact with everything that was going on, because he really was, as Paul Wilde's stated in the account that I referred to earlier this morning.
In his Flinders lecture?
Yes. He acted as inspiration and guide and a sort of general father figure for most of us.
What about other groups outside this country besides Covington's? Were you aware of
that? Well, I was aware of Roland Bondley.
But was it more a matter just of you'd read what they were doing in Nature or elsewhere?
Well, we had no other means of contact in those days.
But you weren't in correspondence about...
I wasn't in direct correspondence with them, no doubt. Well, people like Pawsey were, but my level I certainly wasn't. I must admit, I was still a very young junior member of the research staff. We were behind years at that stage.
Okay, then the third letter to Nature is with Christensen and Mills in 49, in which you took a look at a partial solar eclipse.
Yes.
In November 48.
Yes.
At 50 centimeters wavelength, so that's, 300 megahertz. So that's yet a different frequency.
50 centimeters is...
600.
600.
I'm sorry, so that is the same
again,
frequency.
600, yes.
Was using the...
Yes.
And was this at Dover Heights then?
No, We observed three places simultaneously. It arose from observing the fact that, the well-known fact, of course, that the circumstances were different at different places. And we knew that the intensity of the radiation varied with time, 600 or 1200. And we suspected that, sunspot activity, sunspot area seemed to have something, certainly had something to do with it, but it was not a real one-to-one correlation between every sunspot and the higher noise level. And sunspot was, the area was certainly not the whole story. And we were casting around for a way of
of being more certain just where the noise was coming from. The idea arose that if we observe this ellipse at three places simultaneously, the appearance of the limb to the moon across the sun was Can you shut it off, please?
So you had three different sites.
Three different sites. Sydney, near Melbourne, and one in Tasmania, on the west coast of Tasmania, which gave us something on the order of 600 or 700 miles separation between the three stations.
And all at 50 centimetres.
And this, each place, a receiver, an antenna was set up at, operating at 50 centimetres. Sydney one was the one that had been used for the survey, the earlier survey of solar radiation. And as a result, we were able, by examination of the times at which there were sudden drops or sudden rises in the intensity of the radiation received, and was able to get intersections which... a number of intersections which suggested possible sites, and a number of these fell right on sunspot, areas of sunspots at the time. The sun being fortunately having quite a number of sunspots.
So this was rather nice confirmation that indeed the radio brightness and microwaves was coming from
small
areas.
Yes, and it was this sort of thing that stimulated Christensen to the idea of grating interferometer so that he can have his eclipse every day.
Right. Why could you not use the sea interferometer for higher angular resolution?
Well, still it would have only been a horizontal strip.
True, but nevertheless, if you could make some pretty good inferences...
It will only work for a short period of time.
Yeah, that's true. That's necessary.
But that
still better
that
than the eclipse.
Be sufficient,
Is there any difficulty with using the sea interferometer as you go to higher frequencies?
Well, one of the things is, I suppose that you would want the sea to be calm.
It becomes more of a difficulty. Yeah. Yeah. So in fact, I guess the highest frequency that it was ever used at was 200 megahertz. And also, you tried an experiment on circular polarization. Apparently.
Yes.
How did that go?
Around about this time, we only had a very crude arrangements. My memory was that the change from left hand to right hand, making the antenna accept either left hand or right hand, was done by physically moving a line lengthener, which was in one branch, coming the feeder coming from one of the polarization feeds.
I see.
So that one was only measuring one polarization at a time, and you observed with one eye on the line lengthener and one on the recorder, and judiciously switched.
But was this during the eclipse that you did this, actually? Were you trying to see if there were maybe localized areas where there would be circular polarization? It's mentioned in the Nature article on the eclipse, so
I guess it was. My memory fails me at this point. I don't really remember, but if it mentions it in Nature later, then I think it must have been during the eclipse.
Yeah.
We were certainly doing it at other times. My memory also was that we didn't find sustained differences in polarization.
Right.
The polarization appeared to be changing relatively rapidly.
Okay, let's move on to the next thing, which I find here is with you and Lahaini talking about 3 months of monitoring. And as you've already mentioned, you found that there were long-term variations in the level, which you correlated with sunspots. And in the abstract, it says that you concluded that pretty much all of the 600 and 1200 megahertz radiation is thermal in nature.
Yes.
And what was that really based on, that conclusion?
Well, it was based on the steadiness of the radiation and the fact that if the level rose this week to a temporary peak in a couple of weeks' time, it was probably down again. It tended to go down to a base level and stay there. And
so it was really
the result was interpreted, well, the only other observational thing we did was to have a monitoring loudspeaker and be sure that there appeared to be truly random noise. I guess we tuned the signal generator across the band occasionally and satisfied ourselves that there weren't any, we couldn't, not getting any beat notes, that it wasn't someone's carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, the early theoretical work that had been done suggesting that the emitting level would be lifted up perhaps into the higher regions, into the corona, where the temperature was known to be of the order of a million degrees.
Mm-hmm.
This seemed to be an explanation.
Okay.
The level to which radiation would escape.
And along this same line, you had a paper with Pawsey in which you did a look at the entire, all measurements that you made.
Yes.
Can you tell me about what your main conclusions were from that?
Well, we looked at the statistics of the daily intensities of radiation and concluded that there was a base level below which the radiation didn't seem to fall. In fact, there seemed to be two components. One, a very intense one in which the level might rise to high intensities, but for relatively, this was a relatively small proportion of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when the high intensity component was absent, that there was a base level, which we attempted to measure the absolute value of, and we concluded that this radiation was most likely to be of thermal origin.
And it fit in, once again, with the current ideas about the...
It fitted in...
with what wavelengths we're looking at, what levels in the sun.
Yes.
All right, and the final paper I have you actually co-authoring was one that came out in 1951, in which there's a whole slew of people looking at a couple outbursts in February 1950, ranging all the way from 62 to 9400 megahertz. Was this just put together after the fact that everyone happened to catch this burst, or how did that come about, that one person saw there was a big burst and called everyone else up, or how did...
I really don't remember now, but a number of people had systems going which were, like most of these systems in those days, were perhaps undermanned as far as providing a facility in which you could be sure you would be operating every day, but people attempted to operate as much as they could. And this happened to be one of the bigger events at which a whole lot of people were operating. Well, it was big enough so that I think the net was cast wide to try and find as many observers of different phenomena that might be related.
Even C.W. Allen is part of this, and that he was doing optical observations, I presume.
Well, he was interested in son, but adoptable wavelengths, yes.
And
but he had been, well, I presume, I'm not certain because I wasn't directly involved, but I would assume that he was the one responsible for the stationing of also some radio equipment operating at something like 100 or 200 at Mount Stromlo, so that he would have something close by the optical observing instruments.
And you said you yourself went up there and...
I once went there for a couple of days with one of the people installing the equipment, just getting it going.
Well, he certainly was one of the few optical astronomers at that time who was paying any attention to radio results.
Yes, he was the... he was the main contact, along with Harley Wood, here at Sydney.
We're going to try to get hold of him.
Yes. Yeah, Harley was then, at the time, in charge of the Sydney Observatory, and Clay Allen were our two main direct contacts with the astronomical world, that I remember, you know.
If, in 1950, if someone asked you what you did, would you say that you were a radio physicist, or a radio engineer, a radio astronomer, a physicist? What would you have said?
I probably would have said radio physicist. Interested in solar, I don't know, I suppose we were calling it solar radio astronomy by then. Interested in solar radio astronomy. But 1950 was also about the time when the chief of radio physics, who was also very interested, as well as in radio astronomy, very interested in electronic aids to navigation of civil aircraft.
This is Taffy Bowen.
Taffy Bowen, yes. Asked me to join the navigation group, which I did, and essentially left the field of radio astronomy.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We live down Yabsley on 2nd March 78.